ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Going to read this morning several verses because there's really short purports or none. Starting with text 17, and we're going to go through, let's see, text 21, 17 through 21. This is prose, so I'm not even going to attempt. So good at Sanskrit. Just read the translation for 17 and so forth. Shukadeva Goswami continued. So he's continuing. Shukadeva Goswami is narrating in the beginning part of Canto 5. Shukadeva Goswami is narrating to Maharaj Parikshit lineages of kings, continuing from Canto 4 and including, you know, middle part of Canto 3. Swayambhuva Manu, the first of the Manus and kings that have come from Swayambhuva Manu. We heard Swayambhuva Manu's daughter, Devahuti, married Kardama Muni in long section. Just bring them both. Long section. And then in the fourth canto, one of the sons of Swayambhuva Manu, Uttanapada, son number two. Uttanapada married two queens, and the story of Dhruva, fourth canto. Continuing the end of canto four, that same line of kings from Uttanapada and Dhruva on to King Prachinivari, and the conclusion in that section. The line of kings became interrupted, so at the beginning of this canto, Swayambhuva Manu goes to son number one, Priyavrata, and asks Priyavrata to become emperor. He doesn't want to become emperor. He gets ganged up on, and they convince him, okay, I'll become the emperor. And then there's the line of kings from Priyavrata. And that's what we're hearing. So one of those kings in the line of Priyavrata. So we're still very, very early in the history of the universe. There's this Agnidra. And Agnidra, we're hearing a description about him that appears to be sometimes on this side and sometimes on that side. The downside is he appears to be, he speaks as if, and it's even their statement that says that he was infatuated and he forgot himself and forgot the purpose of life and forgot the personality of Godhead and, you know, became victim to Maya. Now we're going to hear, well, he wasn't exactly a victim of Maya. He was a very elevated person, and in the course of his marriage with a heavenly society girl, that's a nice way of saying, you know, he wasn't the best of persons, but in any case, they became married, and a number of very, very exalted sons, which we're going to hear some more about in this canto, and then again in the ninth canto, you'll hear the names of some of the sons produced by that combination, Agnidra and Purvachiti. Great, great personalities. So, that's the scene. You know, the infatuation talk finished, and now we're going to hear how she responds to the infatuation talk. So Shukadeva Goswami continued, Maharaj Agnidra, whose intelligence was like that of a demigod, knew the art of flattering women to win them to his side. He therefore pleased that celestial girl with his lusty words and gained her favor. Complimentary language about Maharaj Agnidra purport. Since King Agnidra was a devotee, he actually had no attraction for material enjoyment. But because he wanted a wife for Prajani, and Lord Brahma had sent Purvachati for this purpose, he expertly pleased her with flattering words. Women are attracted by a man's flattering words. One who is expert in this art of flattery is called Vidagdha. Huh? What'd you say? Vidagdha, that one? Is anyone familiar with that word, Vidagdha, from Rupa Goswami's writings? Hint? Rupa Goswami, after being instructed by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, of course, Rupa Goswami, we should understand, it's a pastime in Gaur Lila, and his real identity is Sri Rupa Manjari. Nice to remember that. So Rupa Goswami gave up, along with his brother Sanatan Goswami, they gave up their aristocratic position of being prime minister and home minister and the government of Nawab Hussain Shah and went to be with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He later gave them their residence in Vrindavan, but before that, he gave them instruction. He gave instruction to Rupa Goswami, detailed in Chaitanya Charitamrita, on specifically the science of rasa, or the science of acting in one's relationship with the personality of Godhead, or abhideya gyan. Abhideya meaning how the living entity is to act in that relationship with the Supreme Lord. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu thoroughly instructed Rupa Goswami, and, no small thing, he empowered Rupa Goswami to realize everything that he said. And then he empowered him to write literature expanding on what he said. So he did. And one of the literatures that he wrote was Vidagdha Madhava. Rupa Goswami, after being instructed, was sent to Vrindavan by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu with two main services. You could say three, but two main services commonly are spoken. To write transcendental literature, which he did, and to reestablish the lost places of Krishna's pastimes, which he did. He was empowered to do both, and he did both very, very, very wonderfully. A third, of course, was he instructed. He instructed Jiva Goswami, his nephew, and others, and in this way continued the line of disciplic succession, explicitly training Jiva Goswami, who later became the next acharya, who trained the next acharyas. So, writing literature and establishing the places of Krishna's pastime. So, while in Vrindavan, in his mind, it's described in Chaitanya Charitamrita, in his mind, he began composing a literature describing Krishna's pastimes. And in the course of his travel to visit Chaitanya Mahaprabhu from Vrindavan, he went to Puri. That continued, but then he received in a dream, in Satyabhama, a place in Orissa, a place that was named after Satyabhama. Satyabhama appeared to him in a dream at Satyabhamapur and said, make two dramas, not just one. Krishna in Vrindavan, Krishna out of Vrindavan. So he accepted that as instruction from Satyabhama. That's what he should do. Then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu confirmed. He didn't say anything to anybody, But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, being omniscient, knew and confirmed, you should make this two dramas, not one drama. So Rupa Goswami was very happy to understand Lord Chaitanya's omniscient. And so it became two dramas, Krishna in Vrindavan, Krishna out of Vrindavan. And Krishna in Vrindavan is named Vidagdha Madhava. And Krishna out of Vrindavan is Lalita Madhava. Amazing literature. Very, 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 very elevated, esoteric, amazing literature. Made after you thoroughly have studied all of Prabhupada's books and all of the, you know, two or three times, then you may want to read those literatures. They're mentioned in Chaitanya Charitamrita, and different translations have been made. You have to be careful which one you pick up when you get to that stage of your Krishna consciousness. But Vidagdha Madhava means, Vidagdha is one who is expert in flattery. So it's describing Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan, particularly pastimes with the gopis, where he's flattering the gopis. He's expert. So here, the word is being used just in the purport. It's not in the verse. Is it? Vidagdha. There it is. Vidagdha. So Vidagdha becomes Vidagdha using the tense. Okay. Very good. Very good. Gramya Vidagdhaya. Expert in fulfilling one's material desires. Gramya Vidagdhaya. Vidagdhaya. Gramya Vidagdhaya. Expert in flattery. Expert in fulfilling material desires. Here is the translation. Of course, the root of material desire is spiritual desire that's been perverted. So in any case, Agnidra was very expert, and Purvachiti, he became victimized by her beauty and qualities and vice versa, and guess what happened? Romance. Text 18. Attracted by the intelligence, learning, youth, beauty, behavior, opulence, and magnanimity of Agnidra, king of Jambudweep, and master of all heroes, Purvachiti lived with him for many thousands of years, because this is Satya Yuga. And luxuriously enjoyed both worldly and heavenly happiness, Bhoma and Svarga. So their residence was in Jambudweep, but she had opulence like heavenly society, and so they enjoyed both. Purport. By the grace of Lord Brahma, King Agnidra, and the heavenly girl Purvachiti found their union quite suitable. Thus they enjoyed worldly and heavenly happiness for many thousands of years. So again, this is the beginning of the universe. It's not just the beginning of a day of Brahma, but specifically it's the beginning of the universe. The first day of Brahma. So Brahma is directly involved. Brahma wants the lineage of kings, qualified kings, to continue. No, qualified kings need qualified queens in order to continue the lineage. And so, at least the understanding here, Brahma sent this girl. Agnidra understood it. Brahma sent this girl. He did what he was supposed to do. He charmed her. And they lived together for thousands of years. Text 19. In the womb of Purvachiti, Maharaj Agnidra, the best of kings, begot 9 sons. And we'll hear more about these 9 sons in Canto 9. Nabhi, very famous king. Kim Purusha is one of the Varshas of Jambudvip. It's where Hanuman resides. Kim Purusha Varsha. It's described later in this fifth canto. Hari Varsha, another important place. Ilavrita Varsha. That's where this planet is. Ilavrita Varsha. And this, according to Prabhupada, repeats it over and over. This planet was known as Ilavrita Varsha, and later became Bharat Varsha, and later Bharat Varsha shrunk to the subcontinent of India. But it changed from Ilavrita Varsha to Bharat Varsha, following King Bharata. King Bharata, the son of Rishabdev. We're going to hear something about another Bharata in just a moment. Ramyaka, Hiranmaya, Kuru dynasty, Kuru, Bhadrashva, and Ketumala. Text 20, no purport. Text 20. Purvachiti gave birth to these 9 sons, one each year, although they lived together for thousands of years. But after they grew up, she left them at home and again approached Lord Brahma to worship him. So she had some special mood of devotion to Lord Brahma. She went at Lord Brahma's request. She went back to worship him. Purport. There are many instances in which apsaras, heavenly angels, nice way to describe them, have descended to this earth by the order of a superior demigod like Lord Brahma or Lord Indra, have followed the demigod's order by marrying someone and giving birth to children, and have then returned to their celestial homes. For example, after Menaka, the celestial woman, society girl, who had come to delude Vishvamitra Muni, gave birth to the child Shakuntala, she, Menaka, left both the child and her husband and returned to the heavenly planets. Purvachiti did not remain permanently with Maharaj Agnidra. After cooperating in his household affairs, she left Maharaj Agnidra and all 9 sons and returned to Brahma to worship him. Kind of irregular. What kind of Vedic model is this? Some wild things took place in Satya Yuga, what to speak of Kali Yuga. So the description of this situation of Menaka being sent by Indra goes as follows. Very intriguing. Mahabharata is the source of information about this. Adi Parva. Vishvamitra, before he became a Muni, was a king. He was a Kshatriya. Very exalted, powerful Kshatriya. And one time he went to the forest to visit Vashishta. And a reception fitting for a royal person was provided by Vashishta, because Vashishta had mystic powers, and he also had a Kamadenu, a wonderful wish-fulfilling cow, Nandini, and the wish-fulfilling cow was approached to make arrangements, because she did not just give milk, she could give stuff. So arrangement was made for a royal reception for Vishvamitra, the king. And Vishvamitra, the king, went, wow, you're living in the forest and you can provide all of this and this because of that cow. I'd like that cow. And Vasishtha wasn't agreeable. So there are different versions, but one version is Vishwamitra killed Vasishtha's sons. They had this big confrontation, and the power of Vasishtha overwhelmed the power of Vishwamitra. So he was chivalrous. He didn't want to be outdone by anybody. So he decided he'd give up being a king and become a rishi, then become as powerful as Vasishtha, and, you know, have his issues with Vasishtha on that platform. So he went to the forest to undergo austerities and penances and meditation, and he was becoming so powerful. Indra started getting nervous. He may want to take over my kingdom. So he checked in with Menaka and said, please help me go there and help him fall down, break his meditation and austerities. And she got an assignment from Indra, so she went. The part that Prabhupada would repeat, not all of that would he repeat, but the part that would repeat over and over in Bhagavad Gita purport, that just the tinkling sound of Menaka's ankle bells, because he was in meditation, his eyes mostly closed, but just hearing the tinkling sound of the ankle bells of Menaka, his meditation was interrupted. And when he saw Menaka's beauty, it was over. He fell down and lived with Menaka for some time. Shukuntala, Prabhupada would say this repeatedly, the celebrated society girl, you know, great qualities, great beauty, great. Many literatures written about Shukuntala, celebrated Shukuntala. Then after Shukuntala was born, Menaka went back. See you later. So there's the Vishwamitra, and there's Shukuntala. So he wanted to get back to his meditation. So it goes on, like this is Mahabharata, narrating details and details. But Shukuntala was found in the forest by Kanva Muni. Kanva gave her the name, Shukuntala, protected by the Shukunta birds or something like that. So Shukuntala, he gave her that name. And it's described not here, but in the first canto, chapter 12, describing about Shukuntala. She became married. She was living in the hermitage of Kanva Muni, and a king, contemporary king, the first canto says his name is Dushyanta. Then there's a whole chapter in the ninth canto that says his name was Dushmanta. Pretty close. Came to visit Kanva Muni. He saw Shukuntala. He went, wow. And he requested Kanva Muni permission to marry the girl. He married the girl. And the combination of Dushmanta and Shukuntala produced a son named Bharata. So Prabhupada explains, there are many Bharatas, three primary ones. One is the Bharata, the brother of Ram. Another is Bharata, the son of Rishabdev. And a third Bharata, not to confuse the three, you just have the same name, is the daughter, excuse me, the son of Shakuntala, the celebrated society girl Shakuntala, and the king, Dushmanta. So Bharata became their son, and something happened. The detail I'm not aware of, but something happened, and Kanva Muni became upset with the king, Dushmanta. So he cursed the king to forget Shakuntala. So he left. So there's Shakuntala and her son, and they're living in the forest. So the way that Prabhupada describes it is the modern mythical Tarzan. Bharata became like that. Very, very powerful. He would play with elephants and lions like a child will play with cats and dogs, like a domestic animal. The modern mythical Tarzan. Prabhupada writes that. Then later, it continues, later Bharata was restored to the Dushmanta's kingdom, and he became the next king, a very powerful king. And some people say, Wikipedia says, Prabhupada says in the purport, that some people say that Bharatvarsha was named after him, the son of Shakuntala. Then Prabhupada writes, as far as we are concerned, Bharatvarsha is named after the son of Rishabdev. So, the High Court judge has ruled that's sufficient for us. Some people say something else. If you hear something else, you know that it's something else. Some people say something else. We accept, according to our line of Acharyas and the Bhagavatam, this planet is named after the son of Rishabdev, Bharata. It goes on. Although Purvachiti, it's described elsewhere. Purvachiti, when she returned to worship Brahma, she went to the place where she had resided. Specifically, it says she went to Pitraloka, and there in Pitraloka she worshipped Lord Brahma. Agnidra was still attached. So he died attached. And so he went to the place where, Prabhupada writes, where Purvachiti resided, and perhaps, or something like that, they lived together again. So what you're attached to is what you're going to think of. What you think of is where you're going to go. So keep your thoughts clean, and ideally bring your thoughts to the personality of Godhead. That's what Prabhupada says. That instead of becoming attached to him or her, depending upon your situation, best to become attached to Krishna. The purpose of male-female combination is to assist one another become attached to Krishna. Doesn't mean you don't care about the other person, but it's that the attachment goes to Krishna. That's the culture. And so, back to something that Prabhupada said in this purport yesterday, when husband and wife together serve to assist one another in the proper austerities and penances, then it's a spiritual combination. And in that spiritual combination, they are on the same level. That's what he says. Although they have different roles. We discussed that yesterday. So one more, and we're done. Text 21. Because of drinking the breast milk of their mother, the nine sons of Agnidra naturally had strong, well-built bodies. Their father gave them each a kingdom in different parts of Jambudvip. There's nine sections of Jambudvip, and his nine sons took each one of them. Ilavrata Varsha headed by Ilavrata, etc. The kingdoms were named according to the names of the sons. Thus, the sons of Agnidra ruled the kingdoms they received from their father. They ruled the planet under the emperor, their father. So they each had a continent. Purport. The Acharyas specifically mention that in this verse, the words Matu Anugrahat, parentheses, by the mercy of their mother, Matu Anugrahat, refers to the breast milk of their mother. In India, it is a common belief that if a baby is fed the mother's milk for at least 6 months, the body will be very strong. Besides that, it is mentioned herein that all the sons of Agnidra were endowed with the nature of their mother. Bhagavad Gita 1:40 also declares, Strishu Dushtasu Varnesya Jayate Varna Sankara. When women are polluted, Varna Sankara, unqualified children are generated, and when the Varna Sankara population increases, the entire world becomes hellish, if you haven't noticed. Therefore, according to Manu Samhita, a woman needs a great deal of protection in order to remain pure and chaste so that her children can be carefully engaged for the benefit of human society. A little cultural item in here. The importance of protection of women. And it's not a male chauvinism, thing. Of course, people can take something good and twist it and make it not good. But the intention is for good progeny. The intention of protection. And protection means, specifically, Prabhupada speaks, protecting against one's lower nature, one's lower desire. Things are so topsy-turvy that the idea of protection is totally perverted, and it has turned into exploitation. And that, thus rebellion, and thus, more chaos. But the ideal model is, as Prabhupada explains, when you have something that you value very much, you protect it. He gives the example of heirlooms in a family, some valuables, jewels, items that are valuable, and they're passed on generation to generation, and it's considered valuable, so you give protection to that something valuable. Because it's valuable. So for the upliftment of society, what's valuable is good praja. It's part of the responsibility of mother and father is to produce good praja and properly train and qualify the good praja to go back to Godhead, as well as be citizens in the world that are of good character and contribute to the upliftment of society in general. That's parenting. Responsibility. So for that responsibility, it's necessary, on the one hand, protection, on the other hand, not to leave women unprotected. And leaving women unprotected has terrible consequences for the individual or society that neglects, what to speak of abuse and exploitation. We have a long way to go, but understanding that the target or the principles to live by, we have our mandate, or the cultural part, is part of the social structure. There's a lot of conversation these days. Not necessarily educated conversation, but a lot of conversation, emotional conversation, about social structure. And I don't want to open up a whole barrage of discussion on this, but just mention it, that there you know, it's for the progress of the Hare Krishna movement, on the one hand and on the other hand. On the one hand, we have to be relatable. On the other hand, we have to preserve Vedic culture. And is society ready for Vedic culture? Society is modern. And we all know what that means, in particularly in terms of gender roles. You know what modern means. And it doesn't fit the Vedic model. So, on the one hand, we have to make, on the other hand, we have to make Krishna consciousness relatable. And on the other hand, we can't, you know, for the name of being relatable, throw in the garbage can or just, you know, turn our backs to the Vedic model. It's going to not have good results. So, what to do? It's a nice topic to spin out on and generally reach no conclusion. Nityananda from Dallas was one of the speakers on this topic at our North American GBC leadership meeting last year, year before last year, on Varnashram. And his point was, it's not going to be possible to get it right unless you're self-realized. That was short. No. For now, we need not try to peel the onion or, you know, like, get down to, you know, what's at the essence? What's inside and inside and inside? What's at the essence? Because we're not qualified. It needs a self-realized soul to have the qualification to understand the application of this principle, our social structure. But it's important because as our society is growing, we need a social structure. Not everyone, obviously, very obviously, not everyone is purely Krishna conscious. This is Prabhupada's statement. You know, the 50% not finished message is Prabhupada is saying, you know, the means of the, you know, the elevator, that's chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, prescribed rounds, and chanting of Gayatri mantras 3 times a day, that's not going on, some of my disciples. So we need this Varnashram, the safety net. We need it. And what to speak of people that are initiated and not keeping their vows. There's all kinds of people that are connecting to Krishna consciousness that aren't prepared to chant 60, you know, take the elevator. But they consider themselves to be having some affinity. So then, what's the social structure? And it gets really deep. You know, then what about for those of us that are not perfected souls? Hint, it's all of us. Not perfected souls, what should be the social structure for us besides the people that are out there that are not chanting their japa and chanting their Gayatri 3 times a day? What about those of us that are not on the transcendental platform of realization? What should be the social structure for us? So is Varnashram for those people, or if Varnashram is for all of us? It's a nice discussion. No conclusion. It's an important discussion. No conclusion. Lots of dissension. It's one of those topics that, you know, as soon as you bring it up, you hear a lot of noise. You don't hear a lot of unity. A lot of noise. Some people are tired of it. It's just they just go somewhere else when that topic comes up. To help us get to the point of realizing we're not this body, we need to act in according to the body. Our psychophysical nature needs to be properly engaged, and there's a social structure for that. How much of that is pertinent to sadhakas? It's certainly pertinent to non-sadhakas, but have appreciation for Krishna bhakti. So stay tuned for more discussion on that topic. The topic is so nice and so important. I thought, gee, it would be nice to have some wholesome, mature, thoughtful discussion on the topic. So we're having a retreat in Giranagari on the topic, Exploring Varnashram Conference. To share this with you, Brajbihari, because he comes here. Brajbihari. So Brajbihari, being ISKCON Resolve person, he contacted me, said, whoa, let's not have controversy in discussing this topic. Let's take a balanced approach. That is, some people say this, and some people say that. And even the people that say this, they should acknowledge that some people say that. And the people that say that should acknowledge that some people say this. And we'll take let's take a balanced approach, because otherwise we're going to have mudsling. Or, you know, we're right. No, we're right. And then there's controversy. Then there's others that are going to say, when Prabhupada spoke about Varnashram, it was less emphasis on the social structure and more emphasis on the principle of living off the land and cows. And you do that and the social structure follows. Is that, you know, in two sound bites. Rather than, you know, like bring in a cookie cutter and jam it on the dough and say, okay, you're a Brahmana and you're a Kshatriya and let's get going. But given, you know, the merge that we have in the way that we live our lives, do that, live off the land and cows, and the social structure will be natural. That's what some people are going to say at this conference. Just giving, you know, a little prelude. I'm not interested in getting a conclusion out of this conference. I'm interested in respectful, mature, thoughtful dialogue on the topic from people that are substantial people and balanced people. You know, some people a little more this way, some people a little more that way, but mature and balanced people discuss the topic without expectation of outcome, just discussion. Not an easy topic. We want to be relatable. We want to be traditional. And traditional may not be so relatable, especially for society at large. What to do? I mean, it includes this whole discussion that in Prabhupada's purports, he says some explicit things that are traditional. And modern people, it's not so popular. Without getting specific. Some write in Bhagavad Gita, some in Srimad Bhagavatam. And, you know, people get to know about it, and they go, boo, unrelatable. Case dismissed. Without, you know, without taking the big picture. So we need to be able to hold the big picture and present the big picture while sometimes this and sometimes that in a balanced way. But what's that going to look like? And it takes very mature people to be able to do something like that. And if you haven't noticed, we don't have so many mature people around. There are people that go over here or go over there and then, you know, take a side and don't bother to take the big picture. that goes on more than really we would want it to. Okay, enough. I'll end with that. See if there's any discussion. Yes.
Two questions. So, was Ami Prabhupada saying in the first purport?
What?
In the first purport, Prabhupada said that Anidra is a devotee and he wasn't actually wooed by Purushati. But then later he was so attached to her that he went to the Pitraloka.
Yeah.
So that's what happened? Or
Prabhupada wrote it. You know, then the previous verses is he was Google Gaga. You know, so as I mentioned yesterday, Prabhupada seamlessly would move between these two positions. Like he never said the previous one, but he says the next one. Then he says one that goes back to the previous one. We can take it that he had both. He had elevated nature and he also had some attachment. He wasn't a pure devotee, he was a mixed devotee. But very, very qualified devotee.
Related to that, when you were here last time, you talked about the first part of this canto being setting the stage for the rest of the canto. In other words, the messages in the beginning would pervade the entire canto.
Well, sets the stage. There's like lots of diversity that comes from a seed, but yeah.
Related to that?
I'd have to go back and look at the first chapter to answer your question.
And is that the case with every canto? Right in the beginning?
It's just the case with anybody who's writing something. And it's not necessarily, you know, in a few sentences. It may be spread over some section of the initial writing. I'd have to, you know, to give a proper answer to that, I have to study carefully.
Because you had mentioned, listen very carefully, because this is...
Yeah,
okay. That's why I want to study the canto.
Well, you just asked the question, is this true for every canto? I'd have to study to answer that question. It would make sense, but to emphatically say or definitively say... I'm not so studied, I'd have to look. Makes sense. Yes?
When is that meeting you were discussing at Gita?
Labor Day weekend, September 2 through 5, Gita Nagari.
Is that for all devotees? Or just like...
All devotees?
Yeah.
It's for devotees and non-devotees.
Or non-devotees.
It's, you know, anybody. There's a registration fee and sign up and get yourself over there. Just now coming is a poster. We have a poster we don't like, but the information Lal Gopal has, you can get information from him. You know Lal Gopal, right? Okay. He has the registration information. Who the speakers are, what their topics are, the abstracts for those topics. One of the speakers is going to be Shivaram Maharaj, coming from Hungary. And he's going to have a 2-hour kirtan Saturday evening. Yahoo! That'd be nice. Yes?
Why is there so much controversy about the future of ISKCON?
Why is there what?
So much controversy about the future of ISKCON in terms of...
Why is there so much controversy about the future of ISKCON?
Yeah, in terms of Varnashram.
In terms of Varnashram.
Because
well, the hot touch point is how much are we going to be modern or, you know, accommodating for the modern circumstance and how much are we going to be traditional?
Why didn't Prabhupada give clear instructions on the matter?
Well, he did, but, you know, he just like this thing, we were just talking about, you know, Zagnidra, this or that, he gave different indicators. So it's going to take a very deep and studied look. Now, some people have begun that. But, you know, it's because he sometimes says this and sometimes says that. For example, is Varnashram meant for our own members, or is varnashram meant to be an example for others who aren't our members? Is it for, you know, there's concentric circles going out. Where do you draw the line? For example, female Diksha Gurus. Prabhupada didn't do it. Did he want it? Some say yes, some say no. Some say, well, yes, he said it, but what did he do? He didn't do it. He could have, if he wanted it. He didn't. So now, who are we to do something that our founder Chari didn't do? Some say. And etc. So, you know, it has implication on, you know, the topmost position of spiritual leadership. What to speak of how we structure ourselves going forward. And there's not clarity. So it's important how we're going to structure ourselves in terms of social structure. You know, there's governance structure, and there's a social structure, and then there's our philosophy. So obviously the root of it is it has to be within our teachings. Some people read the teachings this way, some people read the teachings that way. So there's not harmony. Well, it in one sense it's dangerous, in another sense it's we have to get it right. It's very important. And guaranteed, whatever direction things move in, some are going to like it and some are going to not like it. Guaranteed. So, you know, therefore it has to be deeply studied and deeply rooted. It's critical. It may result in some rupture. There's a concern. You know, this part of the world they believe like this, and that part of the world they believe like that. You know, what saw the world in half. Or the people that believe this way, they go this way. It's a schism. So there have been studies by scholarly devotees on organizations that have schisms. It's not new in the history of theology that there's schisms over some issue. Yeah, it's just dangerous. But we have to get it right. And to get it right, who's going to accept if the conclusion is different than my view, that's right? So it has to be involvement in the dialogue. From deeply studied people, not just deeply, you know, combative people. Not just people that are good at debate, but people who really want to get to the truth. What did our founder Acharya want? That's what we should do. It's a lovely challenge. Huh?
I can imagine that it was.
Well, I have, you know, our founder Acharya started something on the order of his spiritual master, and the span is global, and to maintain the unity of something that's global, when you have different cultures and different views and different diversities, so this unity and diversity model is so important. Is it possible to accommodate different views on this topic or other things? How do we create unity in diversity? Prabhupada said our GBC should meet every year and discuss you. So, coming attractions. There's going to be, that's a major topic of discussion from our organization development committee that met in Italy this May, coming back to the GBC with some thoughts on unity in diversity for the GBC to contemplate. You know, one devotee who is spent 3 years researching different generations of leadership in organizations and how it degresses, regresses or decomposes or something. And what's really important for an organization to remain whole? And that's, you know, major study topic. And I'll just give you a punchline. A punchline is, it's essential for the third generation, that's y'all, third generation, to become very carefully studied in the teachings of the founder of the organization. Not just like take a Bhakti Shastri, but become very conversant. For the organization to continue, I mean, he studied Islam and, you know, the different branches of Islam and Christianity and different branches of Catholicism and different branches of Protestantism. And it's, you know, it's very easy for things to get diffused. So what's essential to preserve unity, not just on this topic, but, you know, organizationally, the persons of the generation that you all are in must become very, very studied in the teachings. If we're going to have ISKCON 100, that's essential. And there's variety. One can have a different take or perspective on those teachings. But one should know if one has some preference for over here or preference for over there, like this liberal and conservative and moderate position, just like happens in politics, can happen in organizations. We should have, you know, the broader picture. And then there's philosophical issues and practical application of that philosophy issues, and, you know, what's our position about female Diksha Gurus or whatever it is, you know, the fall of the Jiva or whatever it is, Not just have a stick in your hand and ready to smack somebody that doesn't hold your view. That's not going to work. We won't have unity. We won't have ISKCON 100. We have to have a broad picture. The picture needs to be rooted in the teachings. It's not scary. It's wonderful. But that message needs to be shared by our leaders and then by the followers of those leaders, because they're followers of leaders. And then the leaders need to promote that, you know, very, very careful, in-depth study of the teachings of our founder. And including his purports, but also how did he apply his teachings in different circumstances? You know, so the biographies of his life become very important too. How did Prabhupada apply the teachings in this circumstance? Because that goes up to the next one, you know, the context. And then above that is the intention. Anyway, to be continued. So it's a nice topic. Yes?
So in most cases, the Heavenly Society goes like Hansaras, they come down and they...
In most cases, have you studied it?
Whatever I hear.
Okay, be careful with your language. That's what Prabhupada said. I wouldn't say in most cases. There are examples of that, yes? Okay.
So not able to do the role of, like, full role...
Of being a mother.
Of mother.
The mother. Well, Shakuntala stayed. The daughter of that combination, she stayed and took care of Bharat. But she was left alone. Her mother went away and her father went away and she was left alone, so Kanva took care of her. So what's your point?
So my point is, like, knowing that they're not able to stay for the, like, the full...
Full responsibility of parenting.
So why are they having chosen to do that type of...
Indra wasn't considering consequences. When persons do something out of fear or passion. They don't consider consequences. They just want a result. And those that act that way, Varasankara. So, you know, deterioration. So, therefore, one should consider consequences. And one should act according to Dharma, not these other ways. Because you don't, and there's consequences. And at least for ourselves, we should be upholders of Dharma. We should know what Dharma is and act accordingly. And not compromise because, you know, it's convenient or I'm irritated by something and so I'll do a Dharma and feel justified because I was irritated. Yes?
Is this about protection of moment?
Yeah.
I'm thinking like most of us, especially me, we didn't have received protection.
Yes. Understood.
Adopted nature of a kind of manly nature, and here we come to Krishna consciousness. As a woman, I feel at least challenged to be like, as a, act like as a woman or in a submissive way. So, should we try to change our nature, Maharaj, or we have to draw the line?
Well, you know, that's a life question. And, you know, different individuals are different and the circumstances that Krishna has provided for them are different. And so I would say best that you have someone that's very carefully guiding you and help you navigate that question. And in short, primarily seek to elevate Krishna consciousness because that creates the upliftment for all of the, you know, just like, you know, the question 2 evenings ago about the gap and, you know, returning back to our old ways, when even when we know better and we're trying to elevate ourselves. Krishna consciousness is the ultimate solution, so we keep that in the ultimate position. And then we try to manage this question that you're asking under guidance. On the one hand, but on the other hand, we have our nature, and on the other hand, we know that may not be the most elevating position, my nature. And so, you know, but we shouldn't stretch ourselves so far that we break. Or, you know, it's not sustainable. But we should, it's a little bit like physical therapy or a little bit like yoga. You know, you stretch a little bit. Not so far, you break something, snap or, you know, damage tissues of the body by doing yoga and you're like, then you're crippled for the rest of your life because you went too far. I know some people that are like that. So you don't do that. Not extremism, but some balance, something that's sustainable, and then always under guidance, because that's going to give us strength beyond our strength. And it's connecting us to Krishna's strength ultimately. So we manage that way. And it's different with each person, circumstance. So we have a goal, it's given to us by scripture. We have faith in the process of bhakti. We have persons helping guide us in applying that process of bhakti and then managing these types of decisions. Something else? Yes?
If I'm trying to release expectations...
Trying to do what?
Let go of expectations. Or
like accepting?
Let go of expectations.
Let go and accepting, okay.
Expectations.
Huh?
Let go of expectations.
Let go of expectations.
Yes, and a sense of enjoyment.
How does that relate into here? It doesn't. It's just an...
I was thinking about, yesterday you were speaking about we see separately from Krishna and we want to enjoy.
Yesterday I was speaking about what?
Seeing separately from Krishna.
Seeing separately from Krishna.
And then next
becoming time. The enjoyer of that something that we see as separate. Okay.
Yeah. So... how do I understand that it's not about another person or it's not about the situation?
It was. It's in your relationship with Krishna. Did I send you that text, Mother Teresa? Text. Okay. So at the end, it's in the final analysis. It's not about you and them. It's you and Krishna. That's what it's about. So that's where your expectation should go. The Krishna is kind. And then there's different opportunities for how to make that connection with Krishna. And some look really nice. Some look really challenging. That it's all part of a relation, our relationship with Krishna, this Krishna is helping us to strengthen our connection with Him. And, you know, hey, we're complex people out here, poor Krishna, but, you know, He's expert. He does it expertly, and it's for us, it's personal. Yoga kshema vaham yaham, first person singular. There's this relationship with Krishna. We're not off Krishna's radar screen, unless we turn our back to Krishna. But even we're still on Krishna's radar screen. But we turn our attention to Krishna, and it's very personal. May not be the way that we would have designed it, but it's very personal. So it's about your relationship with Krishna. So the letting go is saying yes to Krishna. And when you say yes to Krishna, it's easy. It's easy. Pram drishtva navartate, you know the verse. By the higher taste, it's easy to let go of the lower taste. The lower taste is struggling, and the higher taste is connecting. It's okay, easier said than done. The whole process of living life is easier said than done. The process of bhakti is easier said than done, but it's difficult because our complexity is not because the process is difficult. It's our complexities. We're entangled in the network of the material energy because of our previous choices. Here we are. We have this embarrassing situation of taking birth, and we celebrate it. But it's we're entangled. So the process is there. Attachment to Krishna process. With that, detachment from matter follows. Then comes the question that Adi Shakti was asking. You know, are we to give up our nature? Well, not artificially, obviously, because that's not sustainable. But we should be moving towards Krishna, an attachment for Krishna, affinity for Krishna. And thus the expectations that we think should be, you know, how things should be, and I'm not happy unless it's the way I think it should be. Some letting go of that in favor of taking shelter of saying yes to Krishna. And by that connection with Krishna, working through those other than Krishna attachments and expectations for happiness, fruitive activities. Happiness through fruitive activities. It's a wonderful journey going back to Krishna. The struggle is there because we're just paying our dues for our past mistaken application of free will. We have to take responsibility for it. Here we are. That's this tattenu kampam susamikshamano verse. I accept. I'm going to get some reaction from my past deeds. I'm not going to try to rewire it. I'm just going to accept it. I live according to I take responsibility for my past actions. I commit myself fully to Krishna's service. And my expectation is Krishna's kind. He's inviting this relationship. That's what I want. So we just have to keep refocusing. Because we get distracted. real easy. Okay, it's after 9 o'clock. We'll take one last question. Shravan's enthusiastic. And then we'll end.
Very much. This question is follow-up from the last visit. And mind, where you mentioned, in the dark forest, you keep walking.
Yeah.
So, and then took that instruction, applying it towards it. I see that as observation, how the mind is acting. But, again, it's not one dictation within a few seconds. It's multiple different dictations.
Very colorful. Therefore, tongues to take Shasvabharata. That's the starting point. Matra sparshas to kontaya sito. So the first line is the contemplation of the senses interacting with the object of the senses to bring happiness. That's where it starts. Mind is flickering, so the contemplations keep changing, but the root of it is enjoying. Constant senses contacting sense objects. And we have our, you know, a whole variety, we have our favorite ones, and a whole variety of expectations of enjoyment. Whole variety. And it moves. So we have to make the mind not so moving and not ruled by, now the mind is moving this way, now and we just get dragged around by the mind. Manorata from yesterday. Instead it's, you know, take shelter of Krishna. Bhakti Rata. Just, you know, let me go to Krishna. Let me dedicate. You know, the intelligence is operating and we dedicate the mind and the senses to Krishna's service and the objects that we're in touch with to Krishna's service. Exclamation point. So somebody had a bumper sticker, offer it all to Krishna. There's protection. Protection through devotion. Protection from the mind, protection from the senses, protection from attraction to the objects, and protection from the expectations that don't happen, and then we get frustrated and spin out and wonder what hit us. Get knocked out for the count of 10. And referee says, Maya won! What happened? Without control of the mind, no one can make progress in material or spiritual life. Now, people focus their mind for material objectives, but it's not, it's still, the mind is chanchala because that attainment didn't satisfy, and then it goes to another thing or 10 other things. Yoga requires controlling mind. There's no way around it. And our control of the mind is directing the mind to Krishna with shelter-taking mood, humble, shelter-taking mood, calling, appealing for Krishna for his mercy. We have to do something. We don't just like lounge and be complacent and say, Krishna, please clean up my mess. But shelter-taking mood and humility, calling for Krishna along with our effort. It's essential. That's bhakti. We do something and we're depending on mercy. Those two things. Prayasa and kripa. Make some endeavor to serve Krishna in a favorable way under proper guidance, and we're expecting his mercy. Because if Krishna is not merciful, Krishna is merciful, but if we're not eager for the merciful nature of Krishna, we'll just continue to struggle endlessly. It's fatiguing, isn't it? So we keep making effort, and we get enthused if we're feeling the mercy of Krishna coming. And once again, It may come in a way that we're not expecting it, but we should know Krishna's mercy will come. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.